Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Stories Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and today is episode number 88, and we're going to talk about a movie that was made in, I believe it was 1966. It's called A Man for All Seasons, the story of Thomas More.
And this is a movie that once a quarter we look at a book or movie that's specifically to do with faith, instead of just whatever we love. Although I think you picked this because you really liked the movie, right?
I did, yeah. So. I did. I really enjoy this movie. And I guess it's from a play called A Man for All Seasons. Did this movie win an Oscar? I was looking for that.
I think it won several.
Okay.
And the actor had
Paul
won
Schofield,
all these Broadway awards and West End awards, and then he was also in this. So yeah, he was, you could see he played it a lot. I mean, in a good way.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Here's a quiz for you. Paul Schofield was in another movie that we've done on this podcast. Can you remember it?
Gosh. Have we watched
a movie? No.
What is? No, I have no idea.
He was in Quiz Show. He was Van Doren's dad, Charles.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, not unlike Thomas More, really.
Man of integrity.
Yeah, he was a man of great integrity.
Although a little rough or tough to grow up with. Although maybe Thomas More was too, I'll probably.
I imagine he would have been. He would have been. So Thomas More in this film, again, played by Paul Schofield. He is, I don't know, would you call him nobility? So he's kind of climbing up the political ladder in England at the time that King Henry VIII was the king. And King Henry VIII is the king who had several wives, not at once.
He's interesting because he started off Catholic, and actually I was surprised some time ago to find he was given the title Defender of the Faith.
Mm-hmm.
For some of the things that he wrote, defending Catholicism against Protestantism.
Yeah.
And then when it came down to his own self-interest in terms of he'd done all this finagling in order to be able to marry his older brother who died, Young's wife, and then she wasn't having any boys, so he's like, whoa, this was against God. Yeah, that's it. Come on, Pope. Let me get divorced so I can marry my true love, Anne Boleyn. And the Pope was like, no. And then he turned against the church. So, and formed the Church of England with himself as the head.
Right. During this movie, again, I don't have a lot of historical knowledge about this time. But in the movie, they mentioned something that Henry VIII had written, and somebody had brought it up to Thomas More and said, you wrote this, didn't you? You know, you were the one who wrote this for Henry. And he said, no, I didn't write any of it.
Yeah, he said we had conversations that he might have used, but excuse me. Well, and for some reason, and I do not have a deep knowledge, but for some reason, I have a fairly decent grasp of these details, maybe because when I was a kid, there was this really good BBC miniseries, and also I've read, Josephine Tay, who we did the Franchise Affair a long time ago.
Yeah,
she wrote the book called A Daughter of Time, and about Richard III. But at one point, when they're looking into the history, they're leaning on Thomas More's life of Richard III, and then they find out he was informed completely by people who came after and hated Richard III. And so from that, I also gleaned a little bit of his life. And one of the reasons that they don't make specifically clear in this movie that Henry, I think, felt so betrayed by Thomas, was because they had been really good friends before he was king and when he was coming up as a very young new king. And so when they got to the point where Thomas More's Catholic faith was more important to him than the king felt really personally betrayed.
I see. So. Yeah. So the reason that the problem existed, well, the start of the problem existed, was because of this marriage he wanted to King Henry, not Thomas More. So King Henry VIII wanted to marry someone else. And the Pope himself would not give King Henry an annulment of his previous marriage in order to marry this other person. But one thing that I do understand historically, I mean, this ended up being the creation of the Church of England as a separate entity from the Roman Catholic Church. But that wasn't the only reason that that happened, right? I mean, it's like all these events had kind of coalesced, and that was the final thing that pushed it over the top, I think.
Oh, was it?
Well, I think so.
This was it.
I think that there was a whole lot more to it. There was a lot of... I mean, it didn't just come out of the blue, I don't believe. I think that it was something that was in the air.
Excuse me. Well, like I said, I have a shallow understanding of these things. To me, if the king had gone on being Catholic, the whole country would have gone on being Catholic.
Yeah, and they would have. They would have.
And
but
so for
the
him
reason
to
that
say,
so many people went along with him was because of their feelings about the Catholic Church.
I don't. Okay.
I mean, that's what the whole Protestant Reformation was, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but I kind of got the idea that if, you know, it's that thing, if the king had gone on being Catholic, there wouldn't have been a Protestant Reformation, essentially, in England. Then I don't know that they did have those strong feelings, because a lot of people really hung on to their Catholicism.
Yeah, I think that they did, too. But didn't the Protestant Reformation, I mean, that was occurring... Those kinds of things were occurring before the king made any kind of decision like this.
Right. That's why he wrote his big defense that
made
him the defender of the faith.
Right. And there was some things during Thomas More's life, as I understand, where he was defending the Catholic Church and being harsh against people that were part of the Protestant Reformation. So I guess I'm just saying that the Protestant Reformation was not created by the king. It was... Maybe
was Martin Luther.
Yeah, it was given, I don't know, legitimacy by the king because of the king's situation. But so that's what I'm trying to say is that it existed.
Oh, I know. I mean, I do understand what you're saying. Mm-hmm. I didn't ever have that impression. But I have a very shallow, you know, I just have this happened.
Right.
Or looked into all that other stuff.
Gotcha. So in the movie itself, and the movie was directed by Fred Zinnemann. He's a director that I'm not too familiar with.
I was so stunned to see all the different kind of movies this guy. He did High Noon, didn't he?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I can click on this. Interesting.
I mean, he did a lot of big movies.
Yeah, From Here to Eternity, High Noon, The Day of the Jackal. Oh, how cool.
Yeah. I looked at it and went, well, excuse me, that's why he could make this so riveting when it was actually a play.
Yeah.
Although he also had England, because it opens up and they're at Hampton Court and Tom and I look at each other and go, that's Hampton Court. Been there. When they so much to the point that when they hop into the boats, we're watching which direction they go from because we know which direction London is. And we're like, they're not going to London. Okay. We knew it.
Oh, that's
I mean,
cool.
They were there. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
said,
nifty.
Thomas More lives in the country. Okay.
Yeah. He lives in the country. And early in the movie, he meets Orson Welles. I mean, not for the first time. They knew each other well. But Orson Welles kind of summoned him and so that was an interesting thing. You know, Orson Welles played Cardinal Wolsey, Wolsey.
Wolsey,
yeah. And Cardinal Wolsey was the Lord Chancellor at the time. So that kind of shows the political power of the Catholic Church, you know, that someone would be a cardinal and the Lord Chancellor. You know, it would be mm-hmm. like the Eternal General of the United States being a cardinal. You know,
I guess I never would have thought of that. That's a good point.
Yeah. So there was a lot of political positions, a lot of political power in the Catholic Church, as well as, you know, the church functions.
Yeah.
And
there was not a separation of church and state the exactly. way we would understand it.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Which is one of the reasons why the Protestant Reformation occurred, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everything was pretty intertwined with everything else.
Right, right.
And at that point, though, they make it really clear that what the main issue that's going to come up is Henry wanting to marry Anne Boleyn.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that's when everybody starts trying to pin Thomas More down right then.
Right. And Cardinal Wolsey right then too. Yeah. He's like, where are you going to stand on this thing? And you can tell, you know, that was the beginning of the trouble, the beginning of the mm-hmm. trouble. And then I think the first time that you start to understand, or that I started to understand the character of Thomas More in the film was John Hurt plays this young person named Rich.
Yeah.
Yeah. Richie Rich, I think.
I thought that was weird, but it was because he was so poor, I guess.
It's an actual person from history. I mean, that's a historical person named Richard Rich.
I know.
Yeah. So, that is kind of a crazy thing, isn't it? Because his whole thing in the movie was like he really wanted power and money. And and the conversation between Thomas More and him, when Thomas More returns from meeting the cardinal, I guess I should say after he met the cardinal, he walked outside, and because of the position he held at that time, which was not yet Lord Chancellor, he was a judge over certain cases, and people who knew him started giving him stuff as he was walking out, like a crowd met him, and this lady gave him a cup, and he's, you know, trying to get him to give them the decisions that they want. Mm-hmm. And, anyway, he took the cup. I'm not sure why he took the cup, but anyway, he throws it away in the river. The guy who's rowing the boat says, no, that's worth a lot of money. You got to hold on to that. So, for some reason, he holds on to it, but this John Hurt character has been waiting for him all night long, trying to get a position in this guy's house. And Schofield just gives him the cup. And that conversation was interesting. He said, go be a teacher. You don't want to mm-hmm. do this because, you know, something that Thomas More saw in this person was, you know, this is going to overwhelm you. And you're not going to be able to stand against this tide.
Yeah, the whole, I never understood, at the beginning anyway, his attitude toward Richard Rich.
Mm-hmm.
I kept going, wow, he is so hard on him. And then after the conversation where he basically kicks him out of the house, and he's like, I'm on your side, you're right. And he's like, get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, wow. But then he goes off to meet Cromwell, Thomas Cromwell. He's like, oh, you're late. And I'm like, oh, he knew he was a spy the whole time. He knew he was playing both sides. Oh, Thomas More, you're so clever. But the thing about Thomas More that I found interesting was, which did go along with everything I've ever heard about him, which isn't tons, but Catholics really admire Thomas More. I don't know if I can make that clear enough to people listening who aren't really Catholic. They think he's like the best. Well, he's a saint. But because he stood up for his conscience when it cost him everything. And also lawyers, Catholic lawyers. I mean, I was telling a friend about this, and her eyes lit up, and she went, oh, Thomas More. And I said, oh, right, because you're a lawyer. And she goes, I have his picture on my desk at work. I want to be like him. Because he had such integrity, but he also was really well known for having such a brilliant mind. Hmm. And he could argue cases in ways that, and arguments in ways that were so logical that just nobody could answer him on them. And so here's this brilliant, principled person put into this position where he just can't wiggle his way out. So, which is what made this movie so interesting, is to see him at this crisis point, knowing that Catholics hold him up. I mean, there's most big cities will have, I think it's called a Red Mass every year. That's for all the lawyers in town who are Catholic to come to.
Hmm.
For that very reason, so that they're principled in their positions.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so when I was watching him, when I first really understood what this guy was like, I loved him so much, is when he's talking to the Duke of Norfolk, who was well, can I tell you something? He goes, And he goes, you won't tell the king? Never. He goes, wait, you've taken an oath of obedience to the king, and blah, blah, blah. And so he cleverly turns that very situation on its head and shows how he can't tell him anything. He can't confide in the Duke the way the Duke wants him to, because he, as an honorable person under oath, would need to tell.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, I would be making you break your oath. And he's like, oh, Thomas, you're too clever for me. And he does the same thing later to his wife.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Exactly. Yeah. She was upset at him for not telling her everything. And he's like, well, when you were asked this question, what will your answer be? You know, I'm not giving you away, or I'm not providing a conflict in your head. I'm leaving you conflict free.
Yeah.
So you can be truthful and not hurt me at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He makes it really clear. And so what you could see there was his rapier wit, his concern for other people, his complete understanding of overall situations and how they look to the outside, no matter what he felt.
Mm-hmm.
And the very careful road he was having to tread, trying to stay out of the conflict, but still be true to himself, because he kept saying, it's myself, not my appetite or inclinations, but myself, my conscience, my I. That's what I can't betray.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
Excuse me.
Mm-hmm. That's all right.
And that this whole movie is interesting. I say especially now, but I guess it's always been interesting, because this is the conflict people are put into all the time. It's not always government, but it can be. Like right now, I feel like that's the situation we're put into as Christians a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Health mandates about paying for contraception, even if it's against your conscience and things like this. It's like, but conscience is what informs us all. It's that little voice that everybody knows you can't go against your conscience. You know, that's understood by everyone.
Yeah, and that's something that I feel that a lot of people don't quite grasp is, you know, we live in the United States and we're supposed to be, you know, a melting pot or whatever. A lot of different types of people live here in harmony. That's the goal. That's the experiment, right?
Right.
But yet they keep taking steps to make certain people unwelcome in order to please a certain group of people. You know, mm-hmm, what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think they fully understand that they are creating a country in which certain people are not, can't fully be part of without this conflict.
Well, and that's always been there. I mean, if you look back at the history of our country, I mean, it was founded in some way by the Puritans, who once they got here went, well, now we're all going to practice our religion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, other people need not apply. And they sent along the company that helped pay for them to live here had sent along regular workers who were like, well, but we're not Puritans. We're just here to, you know, be farmers and get a new start or whatever. Tend your cows. And so that conflict started from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always been here. We like to look back and think, oh, well, and it was, you know, so pure. Well, there was no such thing. And so that.
Yeah, I do understand that. Mm-hmm.
Right. It's, well, you know, history is kind of glosses over those details. I'm very slowly rereading a book called The Right to Be Wrong,
mm-hmm,
which is a book I keep feeling like we should read sometime. And it's talking about, you know, we can't all agree on everything. but we all should allow each other the right to be wrong. That I don't have to agree with you in order for you to have these basic rights that you're talking about, like, you know, following your conscience.
Mm-hmm.
If your conscience is not breaking, you know, big laws like, you know, no child sacrifice, but that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Don't make people do things that essentially don't matter to everybody else just because, you know, that just doesn't seem proper anymore.
Yeah. That's my point, too. It's the same thing.
And that's why this movie is so timeless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the man is timeless, too. You know, not knowing it enough specifically about the real history of the man, but just from this film, this character he's very admirable. Because, you know, when it comes down to it, you know, it's a choice between his conscience, which everybody around him has given up. They're just like, yeah, we'll just sign on to this. Yeah, this is really, you know, silly, but yeah, I'm going to go ahead and sign this piece of paper. At one point, the guy says, look at all the names on this piece of paper. Can't you just do it for fellowship? You know, just join us. And he says something like, well, you know, if I'm going to be cast into hell for denying my conscience, are you going to join me for fellowship?
He says, when you go to heaven for obeying your conscience and I go to hell for not obeying mine, will you come with me for fellowship? Those are the kind of clever things. Mm-hmm. Well, and he was really well known, which is hinted at in the movie he had a great sense of humor. He loved a good party. I mean, everybody really liked him. He was just a great guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it kind of hurt everybody to have to kind of go, would you just give in, man? You know, we like you. We don't want you to go through this. Just sign the thing.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Henry VIII had plenty of opportunity to just let it go as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Thomas More would maneuver in a way where he thought, okay, well, if I don't actually say anything, then he can just let it go. But Henry VIII just wouldn't do it.
Well, and they made the point in a couple of ways. You saw the personal relationship when it's Anne Boleyn, his wedding to Anne Boleyn, and he thinks Henry or Thomas has shown up.
Mm, yeah.
Thomas! And if someone else is like, oh.
Uh-huh.
So you see the personal feeling. And then later on at the trial at the end where, oh my gosh, I wish I could remember that actor. He played Rumpel, Leo McKern, who was so great in that part as Thomas Cromwell. When he's making the point that by not saying anything, it is saying something. Yeah. Everybody knows you by being a conscientious objector is basically not giving your approval. And Thomas More says, that's the popular conception, but you have to go by the law. The law is silence is assent. So you can't prove anything one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And, so what it comes down to is Thomas's honesty was so respected by everyone that him not saying anything was the same as him denying it. The whole nation knew it.
And I'm sure that Henry VIII was told that by several people too, but that was Thomas More's logic. It was like, well, if I just don't say anything, then he won't have to come after me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can just get by this thing. And then there was a point, I recall he was coming back home. He had to walk because no one would give him a ride.
Right.
And his daughter, Margaret, and I really liked their relationship.
Yeah.
His daughter, Margaret, comes running out of the house when she sees him. And she says, oh, there's this new oath everybody's signing. And Thomas More is like, well, maybe I can sign that. What does it say exactly?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's a way I can sign it, I'm going to do it. And
that's
when he realizes that, you know, silence is not going to do it. But there was something in there that he just couldn't have. So he didn't.
Well, and he had several children, actually, although they only show Margaret in the movie. But he did have a special I don't know why I know all this. I just do.
Mm-hmm.
He did have a special relationship with Margaret. She was his favorite. And they did have a lot of conversations and logic games and all that kind of thing. And one of the things I loved is when he's in prison and Margaret thinks maybe she can out-logic him and show him a reason he should sign and so he can leave. And she was trying so hard. And it, in a way, it was watching them play their old game again, but it meant so much. And he was like, oh, honey, that's so great. But here, I easily outlogicked you on this. You know, I can't. I'd like to.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was a great relationship that they had.
Yeah, I did like that. Yeah. Interesting. And then the law itself was kind of a theme. Thomas More's view of the law itself. And this is something that I see that's happening in the United States all the time, where people are willing to, you know, knock down laws for specific situations, like something very specific occurs. And now everybody's like, okay, well, now we need this new law that does this. And More, he's saying, well, no, you can't, you got to have the law. So let's see, I have this quote. It says, what would you do? Cut a great road through the law to get after the devil? And when the last law was down and the devil turned round on you, where would you hide? The laws all being flat. This country is planted thick with laws coast to coast, man's laws, not God's. And if you cut them down, do you really think you could stand upright in the winds that would blow then? Yes, I give the devil benefit of law for my own safety's sake. And that line right there is being ignored by a whole lot of people on every side of almost every issue, it seems like.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Everything from, you know, giving the president of the United States certain powers that when the president is not on your side, you don't want that person to have. That kind of thing keeps happening. Mm-hmm. But that's just one example.
But we haven't really, yeah. So what it shows is people are the same always. People to think their time is an exception, and our reason is, our cause is so just.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right, right.
And well, in essence, that's what happened to Henry VIII when he was able to talk the Pope round and letting him marry Catherine, his dead brother's wife. And then he can't talk him around later. It was like, wait a minute. No, I should be able to change this whenever I want.
Yeah.
And look at him by the end of his life. He'd had six wives and brought misery to so many people in pursuit of this goal that wasn't really even necessary, because Elizabeth, who was Catherine's daughter, was one of the greatest queens that England ever had. But Henry was determined to have a son, you know, and when Edward died young, was it Mary and then Elizabeth? It was Mary and then Elizabeth, I guess. I can't remember, because that's where I start to get fuzzy. There was some back and forthing, and any British listeners will be rolling their eyes. But I'm sorry, I feel good I knew this much. But, you know, Elizabeth was amazing. You know?
Yeah.
But that's what happens, I guess, to us when we let our consciences be lied to. Or not informed properly?
Yeah, I think not informed properly is
a big problem. Well, in Henry's case, problem. He was just doing what he wanted. He was like, I don't have to listen
to that.
It's
a big problem. Well,
because that's something where everybody acknowledges you have to obey your conscience, right? But the other part of that equation, and this goes back, I believe, at least to St. Augustine, if not way before him, is, if your conscience is not properly educated, in other words, if you have not really tried to find out what's the truth, the whole truth, without being prejudicial to your own side, then your conscience really cannot be trusted.
Yes.
If you're only listening to what you want to hear, your conscience doesn't have enough information.
See, I mean, this is one of those things that is just amazing to me. I mean, you say that, right? And that knowledge comes to you from the Catholic Church, right? From Catholic thought. Yeah. There's a book that's out now called The Righteous Mind. I wish I could remember who wrote it. But I'm kind of in the middle of it right now. I'm looking it up. But he is, through experiment, finding... His name is Jonathan... Height, Haidt. Okay. It's a fascinating book, but he's, through experiment, coming to the exact same conclusions.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, he's through experiment proving that people come to conclusions, and then they start doing things that really don't make a lot of sense while trying to defend their position.
Yeah.
An example, this guy is no conservative, right? Mm-hmm. But an example would be abortion. Okay. Mm-hmm. You decide that you're for abortion, and then you become kind of zealous in that. Mm-hmm. And then you come up with things like, my 15-year-old or a 15-year-old girl should be able to find an abortionist on her own without telling any parents, right?
Yeah.
And then and you look at that and you're like, well, and these are his words, I wouldn't let my 15-year-old daughter pick an orthodontist, much less an abortionist. You know, and that's the truth, right?
Which is the difference, too, between self-righteous theory
mm-hmm.
and actual fact. When you're really, really faced with something.
Yeah, yeah.
Those people also wouldn't let their 15-year-olds find an abortionist.
Right, exactly. And that's the thing. That's the fact. And
but they're willing to apply that law to everyone.
Exactly, exactly. But the same thing happens on the conservative side. I'm not saying that it doesn't. But something as ridiculous
death penalty,
as that.
Here we go.
Yeah, exactly.
Something like that.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So, but it's interesting, you know, and he's talking about some of the experiments that have been done by himself and others that kind of prove this out. And so, again, I'm just the reason that I bring that up is because I think it's fascinating that through the Catholic philosophy, you have these conclusions, and then you know, here I am with a book that was written in like 2012 that, you know, people are talking about as, you know, hey, isn't this interesting and new? it's just very, very cool to me. Again, it's just neat. Yeah. I just love it. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's a funny thing because it's where the science is kind of coming in behind to fill in more information about something that was philosophically and experientially, that's the mm-hmm. word I want, already known, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, overall, you know, in the philosophy of, you know, I guess I can't say overall. I was just saying, it seems to me and the stuff that I see anyway, I guess I can say that is that people are starting to realize what we're losing as a society, as we move forward.
Do you think so?
I think so.
That would be nice.
Yeah, it would be very nice.
I don't get that feeling.
Yeah.
Sometimes
I see a lot of reason for hope.
Oh, good. Because I kind of really could relate to St. Thomas More in a lot of ways. I mean, I would like to think I could be as true as he was. And also, I should just mention somebody who was unknown and, of course, not mentioned in this movie because he wasn't the point of it. There was another martyr at the same time, John Fisher,
mm-hmm.
who I believe he was a bishop, but he was martyred for the same reason. He was well known enough that, and he was like, I'm not signing it, not happening. So he was also murdered.
How about that? Yeah, I didn't mm-hmm. know that. Yeah, so there's more than one. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Those two are the ones who are held up for that same time period where the king's like, well, you'll agree with me or not.
Yeah.
And here's the penalty, and they paid it.
Fascinating. Fascinating.
And the thing I wish they had included, just because this is just such a great little story, is when Thomas, I believe, was on his way up the steps to be beheaded, he tripped. Mm-hmm. And so somebody like the executioner steadied him and he goes, oh, well, thank you for that help on the way up. I'll go down by myself. You know, he's just telling jokes to the end. He's just pleasant telling jokes to the end, you know?
Oh, man. Yeah. Yeah.
They say he wrote a really great book while he was in prison. Yeah. Just
yeah.
And everything.
Kurt Jester mentioned that when he found out we were doing it.
Okay.
I'm trying to remember what the name of it is, but he mentioned, Thomas More is he coined the word utopia.
I think that was kind of neat. Book, Utopia.
Yeah, he wrote a book called Utopia, yeah, which was before this. That's not the book that he was talking about.
No, that was a fantasy, actually, about how silly a utopia would be if, or how it wouldn't work, or I can't remember. I haven't read it.
Yeah, I haven't read it either, so I don't have a clue what's in there. But A Dialogue of Comfort Against Tribulation is a book that he wrote. I don't know if that's in the prison one. Yeah. I have a book here I grabbed from the library, but I was unable to spend any time with before this, by Peter Ackroyd, called The Life of Thomas More. And anyway, I got it just yesterday so I could look at it, and I think I'd like to read it. But Kurt Jester mentioned that book as well and recommended it.
Well, Peter Ackroyd is really well-known historian of all kind of English things. I mean, he wrote London, a Biography, I believe, mm-hmm. and a lot of books like that. So I think of him as equal to Paul Johnson.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I love Paul Johnson.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, when Paul Johnson has an opinion, he makes it clear. He'll say, I'm not going to be unopinionated, but he's pretty unopinionated. And when he is, it's easy to pick out and go, I do or don't agree with this. And evidently, I just think of Peter Ackroyd as being the same way.
That's nice. Know? And I really think that's the only honest way to go about history.
Yeah.
Because, to claim independence or to claim that you're not biased in any way is really kind of ridiculous. I don't think it's possible.
Yeah. Because the people who do it wind up writing these books where the entire book winds up being a reflection of their opinion, mm-hmm. and it's presented as complete fact.
Yeah, and when they present it as, I respect more people who say, I do have this opinion, and like you're talking about Paul Johnson, I really enjoy his books.
Like, I know everybody in the house except me read his History of the American People.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kept getting told parts of it by people, and the girls did it for a history class, a high school history class. That was the textbook.
High school history class?
Oh, yeah.
That sounds like a pretty good school.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Bishop Lynch Catholic High School.
Nice.
But this teacher is really great, and he would just assign that. And I think I was talking to the vice principal or whatever her title was one time. She goes, oh, yeah, you can always tell everybody taking that class because they're reading that book at lunch during any break, because it's such a huge book, because they had to read the whole thing.
Wow.
There was no picking out pieces. But what everybody mentioned, the kids, Tom, was like they got to the part and they went, wow, he really did not like Kennedy. He's like Kennedy.
Oh, how funny.
Horrible in so many ways. Let me tell you all of them, So
that's hilarious. Really, and that's funny you should say that, because I'm reading a book right now, and Kennedy's not in a not good light there either. It's a history of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Well, mm-hmm. I'm always surprised, actually, when I hear positive things about Kennedy, mostly because, and this is the interesting thing about history, too. And you look at Moore, who's now a saint and respected, at least by most people, I would say, for holding to his conscience and all this stuff. And you look at the swing of popular opinion. And Kennedy, so lionized in his day, and people loved him. Or if they didn't love him, everybody went, oh, you're just on the other side, Mm-hmm. And now you go back and look at the facts behind things, now that some time has gone by, and you go, whoa. He was on heavy duty painkillers a lot of the time. Yeah. How sound was his thinking?
Wow.
He wasn't really very informed about this. Oh, he kind of made snap judgments about that. Well, and there was his womanizing. And so you get a more complete picture. And so history is more malleable. Because is that all correct? Or is that a phase we're going through?
Yeah.
In 50 more years, will there be a different, more balanced view of him or not? You don't know.
Wow. Yeah. And that's just those statements there make me, it's difficult for me to hold really strong positions on things, certain things, because I never feel like I know the truth. And I think that that's closer to the truth often and then anything, like when you watch the news and you see some side presented about something and then you get all up in arms about it, sometimes later on you find out that really wasn't exactly how that happened. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh man, well, boy, did I get worked up. you know, sometimes that happens, and it's just like, you know, so the source of information and the truth getting down to people, I think, is a big, big issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, and sometimes you have to take action then, like the children immigrants mm-hmm. that we're all hearing about so much and dealing with. And you look at it and I go, you know what? I saw pictures of people stoning buses in California and the buses pulling away still full of those refugees.
Yeah, my goodness.
And,
yeah.
And then I read about somewhere in Texas, the Catholic Church there taking in all those refugees. And I was like, I'm proud to be Catholic.
Yeah, yeah.
Because those people, they may personally be worried about their jobs and everything else that this, you know, the threat, the looming threat represented by these refugees. But they look at those people, the Catholic Church looks at those people and goes, those are each individuals. They're each precious and we can't worry about that. We are going to help those kids.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where this movie and what you were just saying to me makes it feel even more important that you should be sure your conscience is informed by all sides that you can take in, because you can't go by what the most popular news is always. You have to go by something that's more foundational than that.
Mm-hmm.
And more foundational, I will just say, than liberal or conservative, progressive or whatever's the opposite of progressive.
Yeah, absolutely right. Mm-hmm.
You have to go by, what do I believe is a truth, universal truth? You know, because it's too easy to be knee-jerk. Like, look at that poor Mozilla executive. I realize I'm kind of jumping around now. But he's been in the back of my mind the whole time, who he had privately contributed to something for defense of the marriage mm-hmm. law. And then it got found out and he never said anything. People he worked with would never have known the difference any other way. It was just his private opinion and contribution. And he was hounded out once that was known. Well, he was acting on his conscience in a way that all these people were like, oh, your conscience is not valid here. Even though you yourself have been like Thomas More and not ever done anything that we could point at.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
We should all read about Thomas More's life right now.
Thomas More, yeah. Let's all be Thomas More.
Yeah. Of course, he was informed by his Catholic faith.
Mm-hmm. Right. A foundation on which to stand.
Yeah, and he was so, but and that's the thing is, it wasn't, people tend to think also if you're informed by your religion, you're stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And they aren't always stupid.
Yeah,
I
yeah.
Stupid, and he was
well,
super
you know,
smart.
That's again, you know, people taking examples, you know, like horrible examples of how to think, and mm-hmm. holding that up as this is Christians,
mm-hmm.
you know, because there are Christians that think a lot of things, you know, just like I was talking about in the righteous mind. You know, because they believe a certain thing. It doesn't matter how ridiculous it is. This must be so.
Yeah.
And they hold that up and, yeah. And then the opposing side, uses that to throw at anybody who's Christian. And, you know, I've met a lot of people whose view of Christianity is skewed by that. And when they meet me for the first time, or we start to talk about religion in any way, and they say, wait a minute, you believe this? How can you possibly believe that and be a Christian? I'm mm-hmm. like, well, your view of Christianity is not correct.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But they're getting it by these wacky news stories that are holding up the ridiculousness of certain individuals.
Yeah.
You know,
and it makes me think, I don't know if you've been reading this at all, but I had a review copy of a book called Would You Baptize an Extraterrestrial and Other Questions from the Inbox.
Man. I love the author of that book.
Yeah. it's
Brother Guy Consolmagno.
That's it. Because I don't know how to say his name. And Peter somebody.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know his name. But anyway, they're two Jesuit astronomers. The Vatican astronomer, you know, who work for the Vatican. And excuse me again. They make the point consistently throughout the book that they'll say, well, fundamentalists have a hard time with this. And they're like, and let me be clear by what I mean by fundamentalists. There are atheist fundamentalists just the same as there are Christian fundamentalists.
Yeah, no question.
They're always going to take a real simple point of view. They're going to apply it to everything, whether it fits or not. And they look kind of stupid. And then there's the rest of us who are more in the middle, you know, trying to sort through everything, but allowing the fact that there's a more nuanced, complex view of stuff than you usually get from the news or, you know, just sound bites.
Mm-hmm.
And so I love that lately. I've kind of, that's become my go-to thing as well. Fundamentalists of this sort, you know, here's the gamut.
Yeah.
Are going to have a hard time with this.
Right, right. Yep. Yep, yep. Well, it was a good movie.
It was. And
I did enjoy it.
Yeah. Mm. Here's something I found interesting is we kept going, Cromwell, Cromwell.
Mm-hmm.
That can't be Oliver Cromwell. It's not the right time period. And it turns out that Thomas Cromwell's, and you have to follow, I had to read this three times,
mm-hmm.
get it right. His nephew, Richard, was his sister's son, but Richard changed his name back to Cromwell because he was mentored basically by Thomas Cromwell. So Richard Cromwell's great-grandson was Oliver Cromwell.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. And I just was like, wow, two Cromwells who were in such important positions at such crucial turning points of British history. Especially since I've been listening to Revolutions, the Revolutions podcast, and that first set of civil wars or war that they talked about was the British Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, Oliver Cromwell features prominently in that.
Yep, sure does.
I came out of it with a more positive view of him than I had going in.
Oh,
a more
good.
Balanced view, I guess you should say.
Cool.
Still, I'm not saying he was the best guy ever, but at least I understood a lot more of his motivations and everything.
Yeah. Yeah, so, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you know, I still like Roger Ebert. Always looking at his stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I found this list from 1967 of the 10 best films of that year, written by Roger Ebert. Number one, Bonnie and Clyde. Number two, Ulysses. Number three is something called Blow Up, which I have not heard of.
I've heard of it.
And then number four is The Graduate.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And then number five is A Man for All Seasons.
There we go.
And then I'll just 6 through 10 is The War Game, Reflections in a Golden Eye. Number eight is Cool Hand Luke. That's one that I know.
Oh, yeah.
And then something called Elvira Madigan. And then the last one is In the Heat of the Night.
Ah.
Isn't that Sidney Poitier?
Yeah. And yeah. Oh, my gosh. Is it Rod Steiger?
Yeah. So, anyway, just a little context there. So he puts it, you know, right in the top five of the films that were released that year.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny because even though it's essentially a play, so it has a great deal of conversation and very little action,
mm-hmm.
we were both really interested in it, and neither of us had seen it before.
Yeah, well, that's good. Yeah, I was interested in it as well. I really enjoyed it, and I'm
glad to hear that list. Because, and you know, it was a best-selling play in the West End and on Broadway, and then a much admired movie. Because you look at it and you go, would that movie be made today? And if it was, would it just be a small independent movie that's really good? And, you know, would it be that admired?
Yeah, yeah. The industry has changed quite a bit.
Yeah.
Last night went and saw Guardians of the Galaxy.
Oh, I've heard that's great.
It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. But yeah, that's the kind of movie that is being released. That's, I think they've perfected the superhero movie. It's like, you know, they are so good at it now. They're all enjoyable. You know, most of them.
Yeah.
I
but
really have fun there.
A lot of them now are darker and darker. And so when I read the beginning of Stephen Gray Danes's review, he kept comparing pieces of it to The Princess Bride. And I hadn't had a chance to finish the review, but I realized, I was like, oh yeah, because that's another great movie that was just fun.
Mm-hmm.
It yeah. didn't have to be dark and brooding and Batman, and mm-hmm. which started that trend, I think, in these movies. And so,
yeah, yeah.
But there are movies being made that are like this in terms of depth, mm-hmm. although possibly not quite as accessible. Although these days, I guess Thomas More, I don't feel like this movie would be considered accessible.
Mm-hmm.
They can, but you know, I guess there were plenty of big blockbuster nothing movies, like, you know, or just fun movies then too.
Well, you've seen a movie recently. Would you kind of put it in this category? It was called Calvary, yeah. I think, right?
I did, and I would. Everyone should go see it.
Calvary, starring Brendan Gleeson, right?
Yes.
From In Bruges.
Yeah, and it's written and directed by the brother of the In Bruges writer.
Wow. Okay.
This is, I think that's Martin McDonagh, and I can never get his name right, say uh-huh. it right. This is John Michael McDonagh, and I can remember his name because I actually got the opportunity to sit and interview him.
Oh, that is awesome.
Which I was stunned at, because since, for anybody who doesn't know, I have a blog called Happy Catholic, which I've been doing for about 10 years. And I just, like, you know, with this, with books and movies, I just get into it and write about them. And so a few years ago, I started getting offered advance showings of things, many of which are movies I turned down because it's just, here's a great Christian movie. And, you know, they're going to hit the point over the head with a hammer,
mm-hmm.
very obviously. But every so often, there will be movies where I'll go, I can't tell what that's going to be about. And this was one. And I was really, I have to say, sucked in by the fact there was supposed to be a Q&A after the showing with the director and Brendan Gleeson. And I was like, really? I could see Brendan Gleeson in person. I might even get my picture taken with him. That's the kind of movie star I like.
Fantastic.
And it turns out he couldn't show up.
Oh, no.
Because, yeah, he was on some other movie that he had to be on set for. But it was an interesting premise. The author, or the writer and director, said that he felt, because he's very Irish, and he felt that with the Irish scandals over the Catholic Church, there were going to be movies coming out about abusive priests. And he, being kind of a contrarian, wanted to look at a good priest. And so,
already interested.
Yeah.
Sign me up.
I know. And that was actually really the thing where I went, all right, I want to see what you do with this good priest. Mm-hmm. Let me see what you're talking about. Oh, my goodness. This stands equal, very different.
Mm-hmm.
But very equal to In Bruges in terms of layers and meaning and message and so much food for thought, while being a movie that you're just watching the whole time, because it starts off and it's one unbroken shot of Brendan Gleeson as the priest in the confessional, and the, you know, he slides the screen back, it's behind the screen, and he says, okay, well, what do you want to tell me? And he says, well, the guy starts off telling him how he was abused by a priest for 5 years of his childhood. And he says, and you know, and Brendan Gleeson, Father James, is saying, oh, that's awful. Did you report it? Well, what's the point? He's dead now. And he says, but what good would it do to shoot a bad priest? No one would pay attention. So I'm going to shoot an innocent priest. Let's say Sunday a week. Meet me on the beach because I'm going to kill you.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So right there, he's set up as a Christ figure.
Mm-hmm.
And it watches him going through his last week, talking with the parishioners and going about his business. You know, he does go and talk to his bishop about it. He has a daughter. He entered the priesthood after his wife died. So he has a grown daughter who he has a rocky relationship with. So you see him with her. And it's really interesting to see him, because he is not flawless, but he is very much like St. Thomas More in the movie we watched for this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
He is a man of integrity. He is consistently trying to do the best thing he can. He cannot defend bad people who did the wrong thing or evil things when everything the church did is flung in his face by these people.
Wow.
But they keep coming back to him. Because I think there's something about integrity that attracts people.
Yeah. So how does it end?
And so the director and I, we talked about that some. Mm-hmm. And it was really interesting to, because they called it a roundtable interview. But actually what it was is this guy and I didn't understand this. It was Reverend Kenny Dixon, who's a Methodist priest or minister, I guess. They're not priests. And so we met each other at the screening because we knew we would be doing this interview at the same time. And then later we go in and it's this swanky place that they have to buzz you into the elevator for because there are no floors in here. It's up or down to mm-hmm. go to the Crescent Club. And here's the holding area, basically. And I'm like, oh, there's like six other people plus us. Bummer. Maybe I can get one question in. And then they're like, okay, here all you people go. And we're like, how did we get so lucky? We're the only two who are going to talk to him alone. And then we're like, maybe it's because we're the religious people. And we're just laughing. But he was so thoughtful. Mm. And one of the things he said was that there's an author, I think it's a classic author, I don't know, who said that there is no character who does something for no reason. So that even when he was talking about a certain scene in answer to a question, I have the interview up on Happy Catholic right now.
Cool.
And mm-hmm. the review, it does have spoilers in it. So it depends if you care or not about spoilers. But there's a scene where there are a couple of baggage handlers. And he's talking about them and he goes, well, so they're behaving like this. Well, they must see this situation all the time. Does that make them bad people? No, they're just thoughtless. Should they pay attention to this? Yes, they should. But here's the situation as it was. And so he's even kind of thought through why they would or wouldn't be this way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was like, I got done with that. And I know what interviews are like. I mean, I haven't ever done one like this, but I thought it would just be question and answer. And it wound up being this really fun conversation. Because for one thing, you'd be talking and say, well, seems to me there are two core things. And he'd be going, yes, yes, yes. Yes. So you think, oh, not only is that kind of like us going, but the way he said it, it was injecting energy into the conversation. And you were like, yes, I'm getting it right. This is the way we're all together here. And then for us, the thing when it really just turned into a conversation was at the end, they had said 2 minutes. And I'm like, okay, one last question. Because I saw there was one character in a scene reading a book, and they didn't show the title, but I saw the picture, and I went, I know that picture. Is she reading H.P. Lovecraft? And I told him, I said, who picked H.P. Lovecraft? And he goes, me! And he just starts laughing, and I'm laughing, and he's excited. And I said, I missed most of the conversation in that scene because I had my head tilted sideways trying to read the author on the spine, and he's laughing. And so he was talking about what was going on in the picture that he felt the character was also experiencing. And he goes, oh, that book is called Dreams in the Witch House. And I went, yes, because I looked it up. And so then I was talking about how that book brought the entire movie into focus in a whole new way for me. And when I started doing that, we didn't have a lot of time, obviously. But then he said, oh, yes. There's the dark chaos that surrounds us all, just like H.P. Lovecraft. And so it was like, it was really fun. It was like talking to you neat. Where after we do one of those podcasts, I'm on a high for the rest of the day, you know?
Yeah. Well, cool. That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
A lot of fun.
It was, I'll probably never get to do it again. And if I do, it won't be the same. And he was just so great to talk to.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah. And the movie was really, it's a dark movie. Mm-hmm. You'll see it called a dark comedy, and that's not really accurate at all. There are lighter scenes in there because you can't just have this gloomy or dark tone the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like in Bruges in that the author, the writer, director, he kept bringing it back to grace. And you don't expect that. He kept saying, yeah, but there was this moment of grace.
Oh, that's neat.
And I think that was a moment of grace for that character. And you don't expect that. And when the Q&A, which the guy I was watching it with has gone to a lot of these Dallas Film Institute things, and which is who kind of was sponsoring some of it. And he said he'd never seen such a good Q&A, and one of the people running the interview thing said, yes, the director actually said he'd never been to such a good one. He was really surprised at how thoughtful the questions were. And three or four people kept trying to bring it back to the problems with the Catholic Church in a thoughtful way. And he kept saying, no, I like to think an atheist can get just as much out of this. It's not about the Catholic Church. It's about faith and belief and doubt and uncertainty. He goes, that's the stuff of life. That's what we're all dealing with. And then somebody said, are you Catholic? And he talked about, you know, being an altar boy when he was a kid. And I heard you got money for weddings, and I didn't get any much, so I quit and that kind of thing. But he got brought back to it. So he wasn't allowed to avoid it. And he said, well, I like to think there's something up there. And I'm like, oh, fine. And then he kind of hesitated for a second, and he said, I don't think you could say I'm Catholic. And there was another hesitation. He goes, but you could say I'm Christian. And the way he was talking, I would say his Christianity and Catholicism or Catholic raising informed that movie. It was so thoughtful.
Oh, cool.
But yet the whole time, I forgot the most important part of why you keep watching this movie. The priest knows who it is. It's a very small town. He recognizes the voice.
Oh,
we do not know. Until he goes down to the beach, you're left playing Who Is It?
Oh, okay.
So that makes it into a bit of a mystery.
Well, that sounds wonderful. So it's just been released, or it's going to be released, or what's...
Yeah, it was last weekend. Well, it's been released in England and Ireland for a while, I think. And it's just being released here. Last weekend, it was in a couple theaters each in LA and New York. And then this weekend, it's rolling out into a larger distribution, 8 other cities, of which Dallas is one. And then I think they will just continue as they can. But I would also really recommend his movie, The Guard, which he's only done one other movie, also with Brendan Gleeson and with Don Cheadle, who I love.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is definitely a dark comedy. It's much lighter and very entertaining. And if you watch it, I advise watching the Q&A, which I watched just to get an idea of what he was like.
Oh, cool.
So I was actually going to talk to him.
Okay.
But it was a fun movie to watch.
Nice. I will look that up. The Guard. I'm writing that down right now. Well, fantastic. Fantastic. That's an awesome experience.
It was really unexpected when they said they have agreed to meet with you for a personal interview if you're interested. And I was like, yes, but
sold.
The anxiety.
Wow.
I'm drowning.
How about that?
Yeah.
That's cool. All right.
Fun.
Yeah, that sounds great. Well, it's neat that you get those opportunities, or got that opportunity, and hopefully more opportunities.
Yeah, I know. Yep. It was really surprising and fun.
Well, cool. Cool.
Yeah. So, but I'm glad you picked this movie, because I've been recommended A Man for All Seasons by so many people. And, you know, you put it on your list, but when are you going to get to it? There's right. always, like, Guardians of the Galaxy out instead.
I sure did like this movie when I first saw it, and I liked it again, so... yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was great.
Fantastic. All right. So next week we're going to do Pavan by Keith Roberts.
Yes.
Yes. And then the week after that, we're going to talk about Noah, the movie. This is going to be two very interesting conversations, I think.
Yeah,
I think so.
Well, I know Noah will be, because I read a lot of the buzz when it came out. I didn't realize it was out yet. So, and I just watched Calvary, and I was like, I can't take anything else.
Right. Well, we got some weeks before that. So,
yeah,
before Noah. Yeah,
and then Pavan, after Pavan,
I'm sorry. That, go ahead.
After Noah is Ashes to Ashes by Anna Lathan, which is a mystery.
Just received in the mail. There were several copies available at Paperback Swap for those who are interested. Yeah, because I don't know that it's something that you can buy new right now.
No.
I couldn't find it, but I found a copy on Paperback Swap, and it's a really nice copy. So, Emma Lathan, it says America's Agatha Christie on the front. Ashes to Ashes.
Yeah, it's Emma Lathan is an author who I'm continually surprised the books are not being updated all the time, you know, continually available.
Yeah.
So I'll be curious to see what you think.
Well, I'll get her read. Neat.
Okay.
Well, cool. Well, thanks very much.
No, thank you. And thanks to everyone for listening. And oh, hey, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm fishing for reviews, but I'm fishing for reviews. Mm-hmm. And because the last review we have on iTunes is from 2012, I think.
Oh, really?
I could be wrong.
Wow. Well, yeah, let's get old. Some.
Although I have been really happy that conversation in the comments box has been.
Yeah, and yeah, I have been out of town and crazy busy, but I've seen the comments. I just haven't responded. I need to join in with you guys. You guys are having fun, and I'm like, I was pretty much like a raisin. I didn't have anything left for a while.
You were stuck.
Yeah. So, I am unstuck at the moment.
Yay!
Huzzah! Huzzah, that's right. So, very cool. Very cool. Back at home.
Well, anyway, so if anybody wants to do an iTunes review, people actually do pay attention to those. And like me.
Mm-hmm.
Praise is always. Wait, this is Catholic podcast. I guess I shouldn't do that. But, you know, I like to hear how we're doing.
Heck yeah. Heck yeah.
So.
Yep. Thanks very much.
Yeah. So.
All right. Well, take care, everybody. See you next, see you next week.
Yeah, I know. This was delayed. So see you in a week.
All right. We'll see you later.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you.